Blog Talk Radio.
Blog Talk Radio's Military Monday program. I am your host, John Gresham, broadcasting from Fairfax, Virginia, where it is, well, it is snowing like crazy. We have got about a half inch of ice with 6 to 8 inches on top of it and another 3 to 5 coming down. So we're trapped like rats. And as long as we are, let's spend a little time here this afternoon talking about one of my favorite topics, combat aircraft. You would have to be pretty much on the far side of Venus not to be aware of the Harrier jump jet, as it's called. This is a short takeoff vertical landing strike fighter that's been in service now with the U.S. military for a number of decades. And we're here because this aircraft is now coming to the end of its service life. And what a lot of people don't realize is that for all the hoopla that the new F-35B Joint Strike Fighter is getting for its transformer-like behavior and vertical landing takeoff, vertical landing capabilities, that aircraft wouldn't have even happened but for the Harrier. And today we're going to have a couple of people, one of them an old friend here at Military Monday, Lon Nordine, talk to us about the career of the Harrier in service here in the United States military, particularly with the U.S. Marine Corps. And what is the legacy of this really, really wonderful little combat aircraft? Lon, are you there, my friend?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Thank you. Sorry for the technical difficulties while we were setting up. The interface was giving us a little trouble. In addition to Lon Nordine, who is a U.S. Naval Institute author of the book Harrier II, Validating V-Stall, we are very, very lucky today to have a second individual, Lieutenant Colonel Ted Herman, a retired colonel in the Lieutenant Colonel in the United States Marine Corps, who actually commanded a Harrier squadron in the first Gulf War, Desert Storm, and actually has a considerable history with the aircraft, not only with the later AV-8B Harrier II, but in fact was one of those rare individuals who went and flew the original A-model Harrier, which the U.S. military procured in the 1970s. Ted, are you there, sir?
Yes, sir, I am.
Amazing. Technology is so wonderful. We've actually got both of you here. And first of all, let's just qualify this. The Harrier is not a supersonic whiz-bang airplane like the F-15 or the F-22. This is a strike fighter. In other words, it's designed to work as a dual aircraft, providing close air support to Marines on the ground with some other capabilities in air-to-air and deep strike. Lon, I'd like to have you first start off, and let's talk about this airplane. When did you first get to know this airplane, and what was the interest for you as a writer?
Well, actually, John, I worked at McDonnell Douglas, and actually I was one of the marketing guys on the program for a couple of years, and lucky it was during the Gulf War. So in addition to writing, I also, you know, worked the program and was able to attend the pilot transition course, minus the flying part, which Ted is the expert on. But let's talk real quick about the Harrier. You know, I think the listeners need to be aware that there's several generations of Harriers. There's the original Harrier that the British developed that was used by the Royal Air Force, and a variant later used by the Royal Navy. And then there were international sales of that early generation platform to the Marine Corps, which Ted will talk about, called the AV-8A Harrier. And also the Spanish Navy bought that, and later India bought a Royal Navy type version. So there's an early generation Harrier and a later generation Harrier II, both of which served with the Marine Corps and the Royal Navy, Royal Air Force.
And let's talk a little bit about this, because at the very beginning, what made the Harrier possible was a new kind of engine, something called the Pegasus, which, ironically, is built by Rolls-Royce. Why don't you talk about the Pegasus and what this engine made possible for aircraft designers, including Hawker Siddeley?
Well, early on, and when I say early on, I'm talking about the 1960s, as most of the listeners will recall, there was a big excitement about V-STOL aircraft. So what Rolls-Royce did in cooperation with then Hawker Siddeley was design an engine that has four nozzles that rotate together so that the engine thrust comes out from four different spots, the forward and the back, so that it symmetrically lifts the aircraft. And in addition, there's nozzles in the wingtips and nose and tail so that the airplane can take off vertically or land vertically. Now, this is a unique concept, and there are several different concepts that have been tried, but it's one that was quite successful, and Ted will later talk about what it's like to fly. But this opened up new possibilities flying both from land bases in short takeoff modes and from ships. And the Royal Air Force was the first to have this, and in the 1960s, the U.S. Marine Corps discovered this platform, went over and flew it with the British at an air show, in fact, in about 1967, I believe, and got excited about it as a replacement for the then very well-known A-4 that was being flown in Vietnam.
And for the Marine Corps, this was not something that they made a big deal about. They sent a small delegation to this air show, walked up to the display area where the Harrier was being sitting in a ground static display and said, "We're here to fly the Harrier," which must have struck the British RAF and the Hawker Siddeley marketing people as extremely cheeky and very American, but clearly they found something there that they liked. What is the Marine Corps' interest in these small strike fighters? What value do they bring to the Marine Corps?
Well, John, the key thing there was the fact that, you know, the U.S. Marine Corps, and, of course, all of the U.S. was involved in Vietnam at that point, and I think many of the readers will recall that places like Chu Lai and other places in Vietnam were put into service with short runways, and they were flying A-4s and F-4s from them. And so the Marine Corps has a long heritage of close air support and cooperation between air power, their air power, and the ground forces. So this was not just walk in and fly the plane. The Marine Corps had a requirement as early as 1957 for helicopters and V-STOL tactical aircraft, which could fly from these short air bases close to the front, but also from ships, amphibious assault ships, which is the primary focus of the Marine Corps. So this is part of a long-term plan, and it was just one of the steps along the way that led to the 88A, Ted will talk some more about that, and then the AV-8B, which was really the same concept but with more capability.
Quick question for Ted. Ted, you were not just a pilot. You were a Marine pilot, correct?
That's correct. Marine officer
and
first.
Does that mean second. You are first, last, and always, sir?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, does it not mean you are a rifleman, according to the Marine Corps?
That's a firm. We qualified with all of the same capabilities that the grunts did. We went to all the same schools, and we went into aviation as second lieutenants after we completed the same basic courses that the ground officers had completed. So not only did we have that training.
And of course, this means that as a Marine Corps officer who has been on the ground and had your belly in the mud, it creates a synergy between the aviation community and the ground community that in many ways is completely unique within the U.S. military, is it not?
That's absolutely correct. And as an example of that, when when there was some controversy over the aircraft in Congress, one of our generals, Sullivan, in fact, was asked why Marine airplanes seem to work close air support better than anything else. He said because they have USMC on the side.
Lon, let's talk now, having explained that synergy and that need for close air support and instant aviation for Fleet Marine Forces, particularly in an expeditionary role, what was that requirement that you were talking about just a minute ago to bring an airplane like the Harrier into service for the Marine Corps at the end of Vietnam?
Well, this, as I said, it goes back to 1957 when the when there was a firm requirement established in the Marine Corps for a VSTOL tactical aircraft. So this was even before Vietnam. But during the Vietnam War, A-4s, as we said, F-4s were doing close air support, and the Marine Corps was looking. They always are now looking for the future systems. So during Vietnam, so about 1966, the requirements office at the Pentagon said, what is our next platform to replace the A-4? And it became, you know, focused on the AV-8A, which was the U.S. version of the Royal Air Force Harrier. And they, as we discussed earlier, they went and flew the aircraft, but that requirement that existed way back in 1957 could now be realized with a platform that, you know, that operated off a ship, operated off a land base, and had A4-like capabilities.
If I may pop in here for a second, that requirement was really driven by the footprint in many ways and the response time. In Chu Lai area there, the F4s, F8s, and A4s would operate off what they called a SAT strip, a short airfield tactical strip, which had a catapult and with which was two jet engines, one on each side, and a resting gear. So there was quite a heavy footprint that had to be built up for operations on short fields with the U.S. Marine aircraft. And so with a STOVL airplane or a VSTOL airplane, they could do away with all of that and just have the AM2 matting type of a runway without any of the ancillary equipment. Much quicker to set up and much more responsive.
Lon, there also was the issue of cost. Ted was just talking about how much stuff you had to drag to go build a short field on dry land. But we didn't just have dry land. We also had to operate places where we had no airfields, and the only flat spot you could operate off of aircraft were amphibious aircraft carriers like the LPHs. So talk a little bit about what was required to operate off these little tiny versions of aircraft carriers.
Well, Ted can go into this because he actually operated off them, but here's the concept. The concept, once the AV-8A came into service, okay, which is about 1972, what happened was the Marine Corps had these amphibious task forces that would go out with a large L-class ship and some other ships, and often they would send a detachment of six airplanes on these L-class ships around the world to support a combined arms force that included helicopters, different kinds, both large and medium and small, and tactical aircraft. And to answer your question directly, what happened was now you would have an amphibious task force that's operating off the coast that could come into, say, a captured air base or an unused civilian air base and drop in, bring their own support, and operate, you know, to assist Marine ground forces and coalition ground forces in a rapid manner. And you've seen this happen multiple times, and we'll talk about it later, in Afghanistan and in Iraq and in the Kuwait conflict out of the northern Saudi Arabia. So really part of the message is what Ted just talked about, which is once you have the aircraft that can perform in this manner, it reduces the amount of support infrastructure because it can operate in a VSTOL capability.
And this is such a good idea that we're doing it right now. Somewhere out there in the world, we have Harriers aboard the USS Bataan and the USS Bonhomme Richard cruising to wherever the national interests are. I mean, this is something that has become a standard U.S. doctrine. And the Harrier wasn't just attractive to the United States. As you pointed out, other nations, including Spain, India, Thailand, have adopted the Harrier as well. Talk a little bit about those customers and what they saw in this rather unique little airframe.
Well, if you would, John, let's have Ted talk about flying, because he, again, I want to point out there's two different generations of Harriers, and he flew both the first one and has experience with Spain being on an exchange tour, so I think he'd probably be the best guy
excellent.
To give you some perspective. Yeah.
Ted, let's start with you, and let's say, was the Harrier the first airplane you flew, or did you have other aircraft that you flew prior to the Harrier?
Now, I came into the Harrier about 4 years into my flying career. I started out flying EA-6As, a two-seat electronic warfare aircraft based on the Intruder, which I did a little bit in Vietnam with that, and then came back as an instructor in the A-4s. And then about a year and a half into the A-4 instructing advanced training command, the Marine Corps put out a request for applications for the Harrier. That was 1972. I had no idea what the Harrier was other than the fact that it was one of those new vertical takeoff things. So wanting to get out of the training command quickly and get back into tactical flying, and especially single seat, I put in for that. And my boss seemed to think I was worth it and put in a good recommendation for me. And so in 1972, November, I was selected to go there. We had to have at least 1,000 hours in tactical flying and in jet time. So that was the first thing when we got in the airplane, is you had to have some experience on there. And the reason we had that was that there was no training command. There was no two-seater. There were no simulators. Our first three groups of pilots went to England to fly with the Brits. They had a couple of two-seaters, and then they would come back and they'd basically be our instructors at that point. We also had exchange pilots, a couple of Brit pilots, so one who later became the air marshal in charge of all the Royal Air Force, Bruce Latton, who was our instructor. And we did not go to England. My class did not. We were the second class not to. So we were elected to sit on at a table with a throttle quadrant, which had the nozzle levers in there, and go through our procedures for takeoff and landing using the nozzles and being pummeled from the side to make it feel like we're vibrating a lot of noise so that it would keep us shaken up to figure out how busy our hands had to be. Go ahead.
So this was not what we would call a mature program with simulators and computers and things. This was very much by the seat of your pants in a lot of ways.
Absolutely, and it was not only it sounds a little expeditionary and maybe cowboyish, but at the time, it was very well organized and very very supervised. Everything we did had somebody on the radio with us or somebody standing next to us to go through there. We got we had a good ground school, more of a ground school than I ever had before. And we had 10 hours of helicopter time with a CH-47 with the stability system off, so it wallowed and was very heavy. They claimed that would simulate what the Harrier flew like, which didn't, because the Harrier was actually very stable compared to the helicopter. The first flights that we had were single seat with a chase. And the thing about the Harrier was it's a very light airplane, 11,500 pounds with about 5,500 pounds of gas in it, and an engine that had, for us, it was the second version of the engine, which went from 19,500 pounds to 21,500 pounds of thrust. So our acceleration time to 450 knots was from the takeoff to the end of a 9,000-foot runway. We were at 450 knots. You had what you call ocular graphic vertigo, where it pushed you so hard in the seat that you felt like you were coming over backwards. And in the first two or three flights, you had to choose the instrument to look at, your airspeed instrument, to make sure that you reached the right speed before you pulled the nozzles and lifted it. Otherwise, you couldn't focus on it. It was a very noisy.
Yeah, go ahead and talk about what it was like to fly the bird.
Yeah, it was very noisy. You were sitting in the bullet of the engine, so to speak, right in front of this big fan jet. As Lon said, there were four nozzles, and it was a fan jet, so the first two nozzles up in the front were cold air, and they were blowing the fan, excess fan air out the front nozzles, and then the center part was compressing the air to go back in the combustion chamber and blowing the hot air out the back. All four of those nozzles had chains connected to a single lever in the cockpit, and you would control your nozzles that way. As soon as the nozzles deflected beyond 10 degrees, you would get power to your reaction controls, which were the nose, tail, and wingtips. So that whole setup there was a whole new environment for us, where we actually had to learn how to control an engine, what it was doing, what the aerodynamics were doing, because it was very critical in yaw or side slip. So that was beat into us, and our first two flights were conventional. As I said, it was an extremely fast acceleration for takeoff, and half the time you would overspeed the gear, 250 knots. The guy behind you would be yelling, gear, 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 from the time you started the roll. Then flying the airplane after that, once the gear was up and the nozzle was wrapped, it was pretty much like an airplane. It was a nice, fast, very high-speed rolling airplane. The British flight controls were extremely light. You could wipe the cockpit out at 450 knots with your fingertip. It was very, very, very light, which was good in the V-stall mode when you came back. And the
I've heard it flew a lot like an A4 in terms of roll rate and other things. I mean, it was fairly zippy.
Roll rate like that, but it was much lighter than the A4 on the control sticks. But like I say, the conventional flying was pretty good, pretty easy to do there. It was when you transitioned back or out of the wing-borne flight is that when you got into where you really had to control the airplane. Now, this short field takeoff that we're talking about, I'll go through it very quickly here. The reason you would do a short field takeoff and not a vertical takeoff was the airplane did not have the power to lift a fully laden airplane. So the real goal of the airplane was short takeoff and come back for a vertical land. And the short takeoff was to be able to accelerate the aircraft onto some amount of wing-borne lift and augment that with your nozzles to rotate those down and lift you up, along with your lift from the wings. And the shorter roll you could do that in, the sooner you get off the ground and the sooner you could get onto the wing and be completely free of the nozzles. A short takeoff burned just about the same amount of gas as a conventional takeoff in an A7 or an A4. There was really no big penalty there. But it allowed you to take off with a full load of gas and ordnance, either on grass fields or on roads, or on runways. The only restriction you really had was you had to be about 120 knots before you put the nozzles full aft, or you didn't have enough downwash over the tail, and your nose would pitch down violently, and you would see a lot of green coming up at you. So you had to maintain as fast as you could nozzle out, which was very quickly, and then hold the last 20 knots until you had until you had 120 knots. Coming back in, very simply, when you reached, you came into the brake at 400 knots, broke, got down to about 250, put the gear down, pulled the nozzles to 40 degrees to start bleeding off airspeed, checking that you had pressure in your reaction control ducts so that you would be able to control it below wingborne flight. And then you came off to 180, just like a normal aircraft, except that about the time you reached the 90-degree position or the last 45 degrees, you would select whatever nozzles you were going to land with, maybe 60 nozzles, and the aircraft would decelerate rapidly. And going through about 90 knots, you would have to come on with a lot of power because at that point you were transitioning to full jet-borne flight with very little wing lift left. In
so
that area,
at that point on four columns of air, and you're trying to balance it using these little reaction control thrusters, not unlike the Apollo astronauts who used such systems to go ahead and maneuver their spacecraft.
That's true, and in fact, the early astronauts had training in the Kestrel. They, NASA had two Kestrels, which were predecessors to the Harrier, and they learned to hover with those. But the two or three problems that you had to watch out for, challenges, you had to maintain your nose into the relative wind. So we had a vane out on the nose of the aircraft, a little arrow that would indicate when you were in balanced flight, it would be straight down the nose. And so as long as you kept that down the nose, which means coordinated turns and controls, you could not depart the airplane. If you let the nose get out of the wind, then you started getting side slip, and you would get asymmetric lift. And the engine was sucking so much air at such a high power that it would tend, if you had more wind on one side, it would tend to push the nose out of the wind as well. So you're really busy with your rudders. And in that case, if it got too far out of the wind, you'd get what you call yaw roll coupling. And any increase of angle of attack over the 8 degrees you were flying at, or the 16 degrees you were flying at, would violently roll you over. And we lost a couple pilots in the early stages of learning to V-stall fly in that way. So it was imperative that you maintain the nose into the wind, and you were pretty good at that point. The way out of that. Go ahead.
I recall from that time that there were reports of a number of incidents and accidents regarding the Harrier, and of course there were some questions in Congress and other critics saying, "Why in the world do we want this airplane?" Yet you obviously survived the AV-8A experience. What was it like to go out on cruise and go on one of these deployments with the Harrier? I mean, what were day-to-day operations like?
Well, as you got used to flying the airplane and you got used to operating in the environment that you were in, we required 50 hours in the airplane early on to go to the ship. Landing in the vertical on a runway or on a 96-foot square pad in the forest down through the trees or landing on a ship were all pretty much the same because you picked up references to gauge your movement sideways and forward. And you were looking out at about a 45-degree angle. You weren't looking directly down like a helicopter would. So once you figured out how to position yourself, you could pretty much land anywhere. The only differences on the ship were the dynamics of the wind, or actually the visual dynamics of pulling alongside a ship. It's not moving in relation to you. However, the water is rushing below you, so you tend not to look at the water. You look right at the ship. Very different from a conventional aircraft, which is coming down and referencing the ship, but it's always forward movement until you hit the deck. This one, you actually pulled up alongside it. You also had to be very, very conscious of your capability to hover so that you didn't get into a chase the ship mode and burn a lot of gas and heat the engine up very quickly, because we only had about a minute worth of hovering time. If we were using water, a minute and a half to cool the engine to get it at the high lift capabilities we had. So you would hold off on that as long as you could till you got alongside there and decelerate it and then slide across to the right and bring it down in the vertical when the landing signal officer cleared you and you could see you're over the deck. That was the first times we did that. Very challenging because the ship was rocking and rolling. You could only roll about 7 degrees and only pitch about 7 or 8 degrees because your jet efflux, your exhaust, would reflect back up. And if it's coming from a reflection of the ship's deck movement, it was actually kicking the airplane around and you were fighting it,
sort of the same problem helicopter drivers have when they're in ground effect.
Exactly, except that in this case, the controls, every time you move the controls, you were heating the engine more because you're bleeding and forcing the engine to work harder, and the temperature was going up and reaching the limit eventually that it would stop going any higher and it would start trimming back on thrust. So you had to be very, very aware of where you were in that particular mode and get the airplane on the deck reasonably. Yeah.
Was it fun to fly?
Oh, absolutely. There is never a sortie out of the about 1,600 sorties I had in the airplane where I didn't not want to go, and where every time I came back, I looked forward to coming back to beat up the pattern with all the different kinds of takeoffs and landings in there. Additionally, it was there was a little bit of the machismo of you mentioned the accident rate, which was not necessarily a V-stall accident rate as much as it was just machinery and engine stuff. We actually had a T-shirt made up. It was a green T-shirt with a death's head with a Harrier coming out, and we called him the Death Machine, and we were the pilots. There was a little bit of machismo there for a while. So,
and correct me if I'm wrong, this was a time when the Harrier was such an intriguing airframe with so many interesting capabilities that even the Navy, which is a pretty conservative organization, was looking at other alternative uses for it. There was a deployment of some Harriers on board one of the LPHs to evaluate something called the Sea Control Ship. And apparently one squadron of Harriers actually did deploy with a regular air wing on board the Franklin Roosevelt. Talk a little bit about those experiences.
That's true. The Guam was the first attempt at working on a Sea Control Ship. And interestingly enough, later on when the Spanish built their second carrier, the Príncipe de Asturias, that was based on the design of a U.S. Sea control ship. That was in the late 70s that they built that. The theory was that you would put airplanes aboard and some ASW helicopters, and you'd be working against the submarines. And the aircraft, the jets, the Harriers, would be the reaction force to go against the whatever the helicopters would find. The Spanish refined that even more to kind of like what the Russians were doing with the Hound and Harrier thing, where they would send a helicopter out low, and it would be slow enough to where it looked like a commercial ship, and it would pop up with that same radar frequency and search for the bad guys, and then radio back to the ship where the helicopter was, which we would take off, staying below 200 feet, go to the helicopter, then they'd give us a vector to the ship that we were supposed to go looking for and attack. That was kind of the sea control concept.
And it wasn't the only thing you went after. There's a famous photo of a Harrier in Marine Corps camo flying next to a big old bear reconnaissance bomber. I mean, the Harrier was doing a lot of exciting stuff in those days, wasn't it?
Yeah, we took pride in the fact that on the canopy rail it said V-stall strike fighter, whereas everybody was saying it's a close air support ground attack aircraft. We had some more capabilities, and we eventually showed the Brits that we could do vectoring in forward flight and do some pretty good ACM, more defensive than anything else because we had no radar. But the only way you can protect your ship when you're out at sea from the bears or anybody coming to look at you is launch what you got. And so, the Harrier in that 1975 Sea Control North Atlantic patrol of about 3 months where they were evaluating it intercepted a number of bears and showed that part, working with the ground or the ship control intercept, was a viable option if they wanted to pursue it. In fact, we had one thing we had to do was all the LPHs had wooden decks. We had to recoat the decks with aluminum to keep from burning the wood and blowing all the caulking out of them. That also was a Spanish ship. That was the used to be the USS Cabot. It was a World War II escort ship carrier built on a cruiser hull, and it was all wooden deck, and they had two steel plates that we had to position yourself over to bring it down. Well, when we went aboard in 1976, they decided to take BMA 231, was the third Harrier squadron that formed, and send it aboard FDR for a standard 8-month, 9-month cruise. At that time, we had a few things we were still learning about the airplane. One was night operations aboard the ship were so bad that they were prohibitive. And that ship operation, that cruise, pretty well put the hold on any more night ops because it was just so difficult with this airplane that had no approach lighting capability, no navigation and what do you call it, ILS type capability, and a very high workload, a visual requirement for a very high workload for approaches to the ship for closure and altitude control as you're changing your airspeeds and coming more and more under the engine. So that they worked about 5 months into that deployment, then decided no more night flying because it was just too damn hard. The next thing they did, they found was that the cycle, the deck cycle, was in fact interrupted. Once the Navy starts a cycle, they have a landing cycle, I mean a takeoff cycle, and then they move right into a landing cycle, and it's a pretty nice little dance the way they move things around in a flow. Well, the Harriers could not take off over the cables. They were doing rolls from the back of the ship, and the cables, the resting cables, were high enough to where they would snag the outrigger wheels, which were about 10-inch in diameter wheels, and that would break off an outrigger. So they had to either de-rig those or move them forward, which took a little more time for launch. So the Harriers would launch last and recover first. Recoveries were quick because you could recover bow on. You could come into the ship while it's – you didn't have to turn into the wind. You could come in and you ended up backing up in the air, but not backing up according to the ship and landing facing aft. You could come in sideways on the ship, cross axial, so that he didn't have to turn out of the wind and you were landing 90 degrees to his course. Or you could come in conventionally and come up back.
So, Lon, we have a little bit of experience now with the A models, and it starts to look like the Harrier is a good idea, and people in the Marine Corps and in the Navy start thinking, maybe we want to build an American Harrier, one that suits our needs and our requirements. And that job begins to create something called the Aviate B. Let's hear you talk a little bit about the development of the B model Harrier, or as it's also known, the Harrier 2.
Well, actually, John, interesting that the initial requirement for both the Royal Air Force and the U.S. Marine Corps was called the AV-16. So the goal was to talk about the aircraft that Ted just described. How do we modify the airplane, update the airplane to overcome many of the issues that Ted just mentioned, which is how do we get improved performance, better stability, but the 16 means let's get twice the range and payload with the same or slightly improved engine. So a lot of work was done. And when I say a lot of work, the original airplanes that the Marine Corps bought were bought off the Hawker Siddeley UK assembly line. But the Harrier 2 was a requirement of extensive technology and cost sharing and effort between the United States and Britain, so that in the end, the United States bought, 500 Harrier 2s, and the Marine Corps got the airplane they wanted. But the Brits also, the Royal Air Force, bought, they built part of the same airplane that we, this was an industrial collaborative program. So every Marine Corps airplane had British parts, and every Royal Air Force airplane had U.S. parts. So in the end, the U.K., Aerospace, including Rolls-Royce and McDonnell Douglas and all of the suppliers, worked together to develop an AV-8B Harrier 2, first the day attack aircraft, the two-seater, and then later we'll talk about the improvements with night attack systems, a better engine, and finally the Harrier 2 Plus, which Spain and Italy invested in to put the actual radar out of an F-18, APG-65, into the Harrier 2 airframe.
Now, what were the actual technical differences between the B model and what the British would call the GR5? What were the actual differences over the A model? I remember them being called big wing Harriers. What do they mean by big wing?
Well, the Royal Air Force had technology about let's get a bigger wing so we get a better lift. In the U.S., same concept, only we use what was called a supercritical wing. One other thing to really focus on, and Ted can address this more, but the AV-8B was a significant technology jump because it had composite structure because it was light. The wing was bigger. So the big wing was the original concept the British had, which was metal, but in the end, the team built a composite larger wing, used a slightly bigger engine in the later version, and there were all kinds of changes in terms of stability augmentation, modified nozzles, bigger wing, composite fuselage. So really, the AV-8B is a significant redesign over the AV-8A. Another critical thing.
And there were some other minor changes, not the least of which is you add more pylons to carry stuff under the wings. There was a new gun. Talk about this new gun with the 25-millimeter Gatling on it.
Well, the real key thing there, and Ted can talk about it, is the AV-8A was a very good airplane, but it was also a 1960s or 50s design. The AV-8B built on all the experience that went into the Hornet, which means hands on stick and throttle, HUD, raster displays, all kinds of new technology so that the plane was easier to fly. It also had a integrated weapon system with a HUD and sensors, including the angle rate bombing suite. It's a TVEO sensor in the nose. So really what you had was sort of a carrier with F-18 systems that made it very capable. Now, in terms of your question about the gun, the Brits initially used a 30-millimeter gun, and so did we. But in the AV-8B, the U.S. developed a two-potted system called the GAU-12, which one pod was the ammunition and the other was the rotating Gatling gun and with a cross-feed system. And it was 25 millimeters, and it fit very nicely between the 20-millimeter gun in the F-18 and all the other airplanes, and then the 30-millimeter gun in the earlier Harrier and the much more capable one in the A-10. So it was an excellent gun. But again, the key thing there would be much simpler aircraft to fly because of the improvements and the integrated weapon system, which, you know, Ted can talk about, helped us to fly.
Now, no airplane, especially a Marine Corps airplane, gets built without a certain amount of politics being exercised. And let's recall back, this airplane was going through the requirements and specification and development phase in the late 1970s during the Carter administration. And correct me if I'm wrong, but this airplane at one point was canceled along with the B-1 bomber and several other aircraft, correct?
Well, don't forget, the money for the Marine Corps is a part of the naval budget, okay? And we have, of course, our very sophisticated financial system. And, you know, there's different consistencies of who controls the money and who wants the money. So in this case, during the Carter administration, as we all recall, the government, the administration sets the policies. Well, yes, you're right. At one point, the Navy decided that the requirement for future carriers and submarines and F-18s and F-14s and all that was more important than the Marine Corps requirement. Don't forget, early on, the Marine Corps had three Harrier squadrons and five A-4 squadrons, so they wanted to go to an all-beastal light attack fleet of eight Harrier, you know, AV-8B squadrons. Well, you know, that required that the plane be developed, funded, and then tested and proven. And, yes, toward the end of the Carter administration, the program was cut. But don't forget, the Marines have very powerful assets in Congress. All former Marines that are in staff jobs and elected officials are recognized, and they prevailed in getting the funding you know, brought back. But it was a pretty bruising fight.
So when was this airplane finally cleared to go into production? I mean, when was it going to become obvious that Marines were going to be flying Harriers and doing it in large numbers?
What they did is they took two of the earlier Harriers and they fitted these two aircraft with most of the advancements of the AV-8B. They called them T-AV-8B. So it had a larger wing, it had the new air intakes, it had all the modifications, and they flew these and developed them, and they proved that the AV-16 concept worked. Then we had that battle you talked about, and we discussed about the financing. But by the early 80s, the Marine Corps and the advocates for the AVAB prevailed, so that it appeared that there was going to be, for the Marine Corps, a mix in the future of Hornets and Harriers. And again, the plan was for a single training squadron, and I think it was 9 initially, what they call gun squadrons, with a goal of 18 to 20 airplanes each. And that was finalized, the battle became finalized around 1982, I believe. And
yeah,
by 85, 86, the squadrons were starting to come into place. Now, Ted can talk about that. One last thing I'll say is, after what Ted talked about, which was a stick with a simulator, a lot of funds were allocated to realistic flight training simulators and a good lay-in of 2-seat aircraft that were produced early, so that the transition would go as well as possible.
So there was a genuine effort to go ahead and train the community that was going to fly this airplane much better than Ted and his contemporaries had gotten 10 years earlier.
Yep. And I'll let Ted talk about it, because he was in one of those early transition squadrons.
So, Ted, you're flying AV-8As. You survived the AV-8A, and one day somebody calls a meeting and says, boys, we're getting the new whiz-bang B model. Take it from there and talk about what it was like to transition into the B.
Okay, the B, lots of stuff in the B started back in the A days, 1975 time frame, which we started noticing. We needed a better airplane. We didn't have decent electronic warfare gear. We didn't have decent legs. I mean, it was good enough for the local stuff, 200 or 300 miles, but we needed more ordnance capability, more fuel, and more time in the air, and better systems to be able to bomb with. We were still iron bombers, using a gun sight and dropping bombs in it. We did get T's in 1975, T-88Bs, to start training more professionally, so to speak, or more like a modern way of doing it, and we continued to increase our standardization, which was really important in flying this airplane. So in 1975, we're sitting in the ready room, and they come in with what later became a digital display indicator, a DDI, or now a multi-purpose color display, MCCD, and said, hey, guys, how would you like to go from these steam pipe gauges that you have in your airplane right now and have a television screen that tells you everything? And, of course, we threw him out because reliability of stuff at that time was really bad. Flying A6s of TV stuff hardly ever worked. So that was the first indication that electric jets were on their way, and we weren't real happy about it. So initially, when the AV-8B was coming out there, we looked at it as a bigger, heavier, ugly airplane with an awful lot of electrical stuff that would not work. And McDonnell Douglas recognized that among the A pilots, and they did a pretty good PR job of bringing the airplane to each one of the squadrons on the East Coast and the West Coast, and putting up a pretty good display and discussion of what we were getting. And what we were getting was
sending guys like Lon Nordin to go and talk you into it, huh?
That's right. Lon Nordin in a black suit in the summer in Yuma.
Yes, I have spent some quality time in Yuma and the Black Mountains, and a business suit just doesn't work.
Yeah, it also looks like the mafia coming to sell you something. That's the first thing we said. So what's wrong with the airplane? You send all these suits up. So, at any rate, both the F-18 Hornet and the Harrier were being developed and flown pretty much at the same time. And the good part was McDonnell Douglas was doing it, so they were sharing a lot of the avionics in the two airplanes. So the electric jet that the F-18 became and set a new way of working was also the same in the Harrier. It was a major step forward in an inflection point, in fact, in aviation. From a Stovall viewpoint, we had 7,200 pounds of gas internally versus 5,500 pounds, which is 30 to 40% more range. With two tanks and 2,000-pound bombs, two AIM-9s, and the gun, we had, with the same configuration on a Hornet, we had the same range. The Hornet had about 15 minutes at the target. We had 11 minutes at the target, and we got there 5 minutes behind it because we flew slower. So the airplane really, really went a lot longer and had much more combat capability, along with all the new electronic warfare systems and aiming to where we could actually we could do the angle rate bombing system with television and automatic bombing, computed bombing, versus just the straight eyeballs to target type stuff we used to.
This was a really badass airplane. You had a lot of tactical options if someone decided to go and say boo to you.
Yeah, we had six different ways to drop bombs. We had laser receiver on there. We could not laser the target. We didn't have a FLIR, which had to come later. So when we went to Desert Storm, we were still basically doing self-contained bombing, which was not all that accurate when you really look at how far down the road we've come with the precision-guided weapons and lasing. But we could toss a bomb into a basket that the laser would, somebody else lasing could pick up. The bigger part, though, was the handling of the airplane. It was a heavier airplane on the stick, and McDonnell originally made it an American stick, which got way too heavy, and we all complained about it, so they put bob weights in the bottom and got it back to being as light as the British one. And the big, monstrous flaps. We had about a third more wing area, from about 200 square feet up to about 300 square feet, and then these flaps that were almost as big as the tailplanes on the old Harrier. They gave us tremendous lift capability so that we could take off with a lot more ordnance in either the same distance or a shorter distance than we could with the Harrier. And
you must have felt like you were flying on the boat with those things.
Oh, yeah. And even though the airplane was 1,500 pounds heavier, we got a lot more lift out of the engine with the way they changed the nozzles, and we could convert some of our forward speed at about 50 to 60 knots into about 2,500 pounds of lift, so we could come back with a heavier airplane and do a 60-knot rolling vertical landing and still shut down in an 1,100-foot strip. So it brought real short takeoff and vertical landing capability to the Marine Corps with modern systems on there, much safer and much more performance in the aircraft.
You had talked earlier about how much fun the A model was to fly. You made the Marine Corps give you money every month and a paycheck to do this. You must have been having a ball with this new airplane.
Well, the new airplane took a little getting used to. I came back to it from a 3-year tour in the embassy in Spain, so I hadn't been flying there other than sneaking down to my buddies in the Spanish squadron and getting a hop every 3 or 4 months in the old airplane. So when I came back, here was the electric jet with computers and all that stuff, and I was a Luddite. I had no idea how to use computers, didn't want to touch them, and basically was afraid of them. So when I got in that airplane, it was a very busy familiarization period for about 3 months of trying to keep up with the computer or find myself when I punched the button that I didn't know what happened and where'd all my presentations go. That also was a little dangerous as you started to learn in flying into those. For the older guys, not so much for the new guys. The new guys were computer geeks. The old guys were still flying steam pipe gauges. But once you got familiar with it, then the venue or the agenda opened up to where you had all kinds of possibilities for applications. And the flying, actually, even though it was a little more of a truck compared to the Aviate A, a little bit more mass, so it wasn't quite as quick, it was still a tremendously capable airplane and a tremendous fun airplane from an air show maneuver type flying, you know, as far as you want to horse around with it. It was really good with that. But from the professional side, it brought us into a whole new era of expeditionary operations. And that's where the Spanish...
Now, you just used the word professional, and as we all know, no airplane program ever succeeds without standout personalities that come and rise to the top and act as leadership and stability in a community. Talk a little bit about the personalities who made the B-model Harrier work for the U.S. Marine Corps back when you were getting used to flying it.
And Lon can pop in with a couple of McDonnell Douglas names. I've got a few, but we had some test pilots that started out in the AV-8A program that carried it on through. Harry Blott, who later became famous for the V-22 and as part of the design team for the F-35, was one of the first test pilots. In fact, did the first engine out test in the AV-8A. He was up in the leadership, Nav Air leadership at that time. The B was starting to come in, and was a real driver for all these new issues we needed. General Miller at the time, who was Colonel Miller, who brought the AV-8A, went to Farnborough and said, "I want to fly the AV-8A," was the director of Marine Corps Aviation, and he was a strong proponent and a strong protector of the program to keep it moving. On the McDonnell Douglas side, a guy named Hank Wall and Ed Harper were the two guys who were running the program at the time, Ed Harper and then Hank Wall. Ed Harper was a World War II Black Sheep Marine ace with Pappy Boynton, and he did wonderful things for the keeping that thing on focus in the Marine Corps. And then Hank Wall, who was a McDonnell Douglas engineer turned program manager, carried it through all the testing and everything to field it. Then you had
Let's not forget one other name for McDonnell Douglas, a little-known guy by the name of Eugene Adam. Talk a little bit about him.
Lon?
You know what? This is funny because I was a chart flipper for Gene Adam during a couple of those briefings that Ted talked about. And this guy talked so fast that you could go through two charts a second.
For those who do not know, Eugene Adam is generally considered the father of the modern cockpit design, including heads-up displays and hands-on throttle and stick. I mean, every pilot who's ever flown those birds, at some point, you know, genuflects in the direction of Eugene Adam.
Yeah, Gene Adam contributed significantly to the Hornet and the Harrier, but I'll tell you a funny story. Gene Adam would go out and brief about the technology that Ted was talking about, and he's right. I actually took the same pilot training course, the ground school portion that Ted took, and there was a whole bunch of Luddites in there going, "This is not going to work." But Gene showed it would, and the other thing that was funny was just that technology leap that Ted talked about, just like we have today of getting used to computers and cell phones and stuff, that same thing occurred. But I got to tell you a funny story that Gene told me once, and I went with him on one of these, and it scared the hell out of me. The other thing that came a bit later was night vision goggles. And one time Gene Adam and I sat in the car, and he drove around sections of rural St. Louis in the dark with no lights on in a car with night vision goggles. And I was the guy in the other seat saying, "Watch out, here comes a car."
So
nobody could say the man didn't go and try out his own stuff at the risk of his own carcass. Unfortunately, he had a tendency, as you know, to take others with him on the test. Lon, just talking about improvements to the basic B model. Obviously, this thing was a technical leap, but one of the features that was built into the B that was oh so American was growth room, growth potential. There was room to add new things, new sensors, new systems, new displays, new other things. What kinds of evolutions did we get out of the basic AV-8B over the years that followed?
Well, there's three generations, if you would, within the AV-8B. Now, Ted flew the AV-8B day attack aircraft, they call it, and there was 161 of those built, and that was an airplane with an angle rate bombing suite, and it was used in the Gulf War, and Ted will talk more about that. Now, after that, and right about the Gulf War time, the Brits, I have to give them credit, they and the United States with the Hornet were working on new technology, which is to put a FLIR, forward-looking infrared sensor, in the nose of the airplane, and a FLIR-capable HUD, head-up display, and night vision goggles, so you could actually fly at night with the capability as if it's day. So 66 of those were built. So that was the next airplane that occurred after the day attack. And with that came a new, what they call -408 engine, which had more thrust, about 5,000 pounds more thrust. And Ted can talk about the impact of that, because that really expanded the capability. And the problem, as Ted discussed, is you were kind of critical on coming back to land if you were carrying bombs and extra fuel. With the additional 4,000 to 5,000 pounds of thrust, it made it a lot easier so you could add more electronics and weight in the airplane.
Then what we today call bring back weight.
Exactly, and growth weight too. And then Italy and Spain had the requirement to have a full strike fighter that they used on their carriers and land-based. So the actual F-18 radar, the APG-65, was added to the airplane. Now it added about 1,000 pounds of weight in the nose, but they also, because of critical CG, they had to put some of the boxes in the back end of the airplane to make sure it balanced out. So you have, as I said, three different versions of the AVAB, plus you have the two-seater. So there's four, really. Day attack, you had the night attack, which is about 66 of those were built, and you had the radar-equipped airplane where they built, for the U.S., 45 of them. But then one more interesting element that Pat Finneran came up with, who was a program manager, which was to take the older day attack airplanes, which Ted will talk about, flying in the Gulf War, and remanufacture, they called it, which means rework them to the later radar-equipped version. So the fleet that's out there today is very young, actually, compared to Hornets, because they took the older airplanes and they reworked them with a new fuselage and a radar and an upgraded engine so that they improve their capability.
So this is the primary version, and what does that radar version give you now? I mean, what new whiz-bang capabilities does it add to the fray?
Well, the fleet today is three kinds of airplanes. The training squadron has some night attack airplanes. As I said, there were 66 of those, a few radar, and mostly around 20 surviving two-seater airplanes with the bigger engine. Okay, so that's what you do when you start training. Then you go to the training squadron and fly a single-seat airplane, either a radar or a night attack. And then you go to an operational squadron where today they have a mix of mostly radar but with a couple night attack mixed in. When you're flying the radar airplane, you literally have the same radar as the F-18, the early version of the F-18. It's called an APG-65. Very good radar. Getting older now, but good. And they keep upgrading it so that now you have a full radar that you can go look for adversaries, do mapping. But the big thing now is that airplane has a legitimate AIM-120 beyond visual range missile capability. So if you're doing a nose-to-nose fight with an enemy fighter, you can shoot him like he can shoot you.
So in other words, this airplane fires the same missiles as the Hornets. And, oh, by the way, if you get into a visual fight, you've got all the benefits of being in a VSTOL airplane that can do VIFing and other good things.
Well, I'll let Ted talk more about that as the pilot, but yes, you're correct, John. It has the same radar as the Hornet. It has the AIM-120 missile. It has the AIM-9 and the excellent gun. Now, it doesn't have the helmet-mounted cueing system, but again, the aircraft is a strike fighter. But yes, it now can defend itself and, in fact, perform fleet air defense for the Spanish and the Italian Navy and U.S. as required.
And let's finish up this discussion with Ted. Ted, you got to go and take the Harrier into battle. And this occurred, obviously, in 1991 during Operation Desert Storm. What were you doing then? Where were you? And what was your wartime experience in the Harrier?
We had just come back. I had a squadron in 1989. I took over VMA 542. And immediately deployed for 7 months to Japan for a WESPAC unit deployment program. We flew over there with 20 airplanes. I lost one of them and left the airplanes there for the squadron relieving us, and we came back in May of 1990 with kind of like, what's going to happen next? About the same time we got back, and we're picking up some pretty old airplanes And I was looking forward to about 18 months of garrison duty as a squadron commander. Saddam Hussein obliged me by invading Kuwait. And since my guys were the most recently deployed, trained, the full-up team, they pulled all of my people back. They put some in the training squadron and stuff, gave me the pick of the litter, so to speak, and then gave me the pick of the litter of all the Harriers on the base to get up as quickly as possible, a full-up squadron of deployable aircraft, already all high-timed, all the newest parts and ready to go.
Correct me if I'm wrong. You were at Marine Corps Air Station Yuma, Arizona, as part of the 1st Marine Air Wing at this point?
No, I'm sorry. No, we were at Cherry Point, the 2nd Marine Air Wing.
Oh, okay.
Yuma, strangely enough, we were at Cherry Point. Yuma had the obligation and the assignment to go to in what we called MAG 70 at that time, which was the Mideast Marine Expeditionary Force. They would be the first deployed. So those guys came through Cherry Point about the same time we did. We realized it had to be a much bigger force, so they started mobilizing both air wings to feed the Middle East group over there. So we took off and we translanded in pods of six airplanes behind a KC-10. We flew to Rota, Spain. It was a 10-hour flight. Landed there. 12 hours later, we took off again and went into Sheikh Issa Air Base, a brand new air base in Bahrain, which we only had hand-drawn charts for because it was so new, it was secret, and no one really knew where it was except for some controllers who put us in there. So we landed there.
Two quick questions. I know that they called it Sheikh Easy or Shakey's Pizza. How good was the base facility that you went into?
The base was a brand new base. It was set up for no more than two squadrons of F-16s that were in the Bahraini Air Force. However, it was a monstrous base. It had 12,000 feet of runway and had a great big parking mat area. Eventually, there were 150 airplanes parked there, and we overwhelmed the quarters. And we were all living in tents, and every other building we could have, our office buildings, had four squadrons in each building, which was basically a single squadron building. Had U.S. Air Force F-4Gs, and then F-18s, A-6s, EA-6s, and C-130s at that base as well. And then we moved up, we and the other squadron, VMA 311, moved up to what we called the soccer stadium on the coast of Saudi Arabia within 2 months of being there. And so in November timeframe, we got into just a little south of the town of Jubail, a big port where all of the supplies were coming in. We had an 8,000-foot runway that was deteriorating very badly and an unused soccer stadium that was amazing in its, it was brand new and never used and completely covered in dust. It was like a time machine. So we operated out of there. We had 66 airplanes eventually and 20 OB-10s, and we were the forward base, forward most deployed tactical jets there. First day of the war.
Just a real quick question, deploying. What's it like to fly a Harrier for 18 hours and what sort of amenities did you have to make to be able to go and do a nonstop flight that long?
Well, the cockpit was a nice cockpit. The seat was comfortable. You could spread your legs and move around, loosen up your straps, and you could pack a couple of pizzas and a few Cokes on either side there, along with your navigation books and things. Then as we got up and we were flying along with the tanker, we would be on either side of the tanker at about 32,000 feet. As you got tired, you would set your bingo button about 200 pounds below where you were so that as the fuel burned off, you would get a tweedledee sound, dee-dee-dee-dee-dee, in your ears that would wake you up if you were dozing. So you pretty much just flew formation, really loose formation. We tanked about eight times on the way over, and then another five times over Egypt and on into Saudi Arabia behind those. But you get used to it. It's a long flight. The hard part is you're in a survival suit, which is a rather restrictive, very heavy canvas-type suit that if you punch out over the water, gives you a couple hours of survival time in the cold water. But it's not real comfortable sitting in an airplane for 8 or 9 hours.
Needless so to say, and of course, having to use piddle packs to go ahead and deal with the realities of nature. What were operations out of the soccer stadium facility like, and what was it like when you went to war in January of 91?
Well, first off, you know, I got to throw some kudos out. On the when we got to the soccer stadium, our troops went like maniacs into building that place into a usable area. They built tents in the parking lot for us, built office spaces up in the stadium, which was a glass-enclosed air-conditioned area, which was really good, and we tried to get everybody up there as often as possible while it was still warm, and then later on got them in there when it was real cold, because it did get cold in the December, January, February timeframe. So these guys worked their tails off. They were working 16, 17 hours a day, and you had to, you know, as a squadron commander, I would make it a point to go down to the tents and pull them off the airplanes and make them go have a day off, and I'd come check on them by name to make sure they were resting, because they were just so enthused about getting the airplanes up and moving. So we had we built some tents on the tarmac that we had our operations building in, I mean our maintenance operations. And they later came and built what we call cocoons, four inflatable buildings that you could put two airplanes in. And that kept the winds off of them there when you had the big Shamal dust storms. They could still be maintaining the airplanes inside those things. And during the cold and rain, it was really good to get the guys out of the water. The next thing we did was the CBs and the Marine engineers came in and built parking ramps in the shape of a comb alongside the runway. We had about 3,500-foot long strip that was a parallel taxi strip with access every, say, 40 feet or so, where we could park an airplane directly facing onto the runway and literally a nose right on the edge of the runway, and then another set behind them so we could put all 60 airplanes ready to where you could fire them up and just immediately roll out onto the runway wherever you happen to be and have 3,000 or 4,000 feet of roll to take off and have people landing behind you without getting in any each other's way.
What was it like to take the airplane into combat, and what was it like to lead a squadron of these airplanes into combat?
Well, we really got busy studying up all the bad stuff. Your intel brief every day showed that there was an impenetrable triple layer of missiles and ZSU-23-4 guns as you crossed the border. It turned out not to be quite that bad, but we were pretty nervous about going in there, and there were only three of us who had any combat experience whatsoever, and mine had been 20 years before in Vietnam. I had a Brit, a very professional Brit with me, who was one part of my ops department, and he really set things up for ease of operations and quickness of briefing and understanding where you needed to go. So you get pretty nervous while you're doing the briefs, but you go out in the airplane, and as soon as you did your pre-flight and climbed in and said goodbye to your plane captain and closed that canopy, that slamming shut of that canopy was like, I'm in my office. I think I can do this. And it was a calming feeling. And then it was just business. Fire up the airplane, get out on the runway, and take off, get your wingman on the side, check in with the frequencies for the air controllers out there, get your targets, and be arranging your cockpit and your armament systems so that as soon as you cross that border, make one transmission among the flight, which was Armstrong, which meant turn everything on so that you don't forget to have master arm on and not be able to drop when you're going in. First day up, we were pretty excited about, we got scrambled. We weren't supposed to fly for a couple of weeks. There was a lot of interdiction going on, but we had some Marines under fire. A intelligence team was on the other side of the border, and they were under fire by some S-30 artillery, and they called our alert ready divisions. We had three divisions, four airplanes each from each one of the squadrons, and we flew up and got all of our ECM was lit up and getting kind of nervous. My three wingies had not been in combat before. And we got contact with an OV-10 who happened to be flying overhead the target, which was really interesting. So, and it turned out that most of the ECM was spoofing. It was not real that the radars were shooting. So we went in and rolled in. As we're rolling in, my first guy, I went in and pulled off. My second guy went in. Third guy had a hung bomb and pulled off. And we're coming back around and getting ready to roll in, and suddenly an SA-7, big old smoky missile, goes screaming right by me. And it was heading towards the guy in front of me, so I was yelling for him, get in the clouds. He rolled over, and it went past him. And then things that we don't notice, as we came back, my guys were telling me, did you see all the ground fire down there? I had no idea that there was ground fire because all I saw was it had been raining and I was seeing reflections in little puddles. Turns out those reflections were actually guys shooting at us with guns. So the Iraqis had a thing where they would lay their soldiers down and take all their AK-47s in groups like platoons and shoot them into the air straight up. So and they were only good to about 3,000 feet. So that was one of the things they were doing there. So it was coming back, of course. First two sorties for everybody were kind of like break your virginity, and then you started learning what I really have to do and what I really need and don't need to fly, and then it became more routine. Still had a few very challenging hops where you were very nervous and didn't sleep at all, and you head up the next day and you dive down through the crap coming up at you, which was kind of pretty in some ways. And get your weapons off and come back. 37 millimeters golden hose were really pretty. They'd shoot five rounds and it would kind of float. And you'd watch this stuff come up. And as long as it was moving, you were safe. As soon as it stopped moving on your canopy, you said, oh, shit, that's for me. And you'd start maneuvering. You knew it was.
Did you ever wind up losing any aircraft? I know that some Harriers were taken down by different missiles and other threats during Desert Storm.
Yes, we had. There were five airplanes lost in the combat. There were six airplanes total. One was an accident, but five airplanes lost in combat. Four of them to missiles. The very thing that makes us expeditionary capable, our nozzles and stuff, is also a missile magnet. So as we worked an area where nothing had happened, no missiles, no air-to-ground or surface-to-air stuff had coming up, and we had forward air controllers and F-18s, and we're like the three airplanes that got shot early on had been out there for, there had been three flights before them with no incidents whatsoever. And so pulling off target one time, each one of these guys took a hit in the nozzles. My squadron lost two. I had one guy get hit in the nozzles, and he tried to fly into Al Jaber, which had a big air battle going on, and an F-18 escorting him, and then he was burning and lost his hydraulics and punched out as the airplane pitched over at about 1,000 feet. And he walked home. It took him 3 days to get home. He went through every nursing station on the way home and came back with a big grin. The other guy was not so fortunate, and we think possibly he had an asymmetric drop, where he was diving at night, which was really hard to do in a day attack airplane. No visual, really good references, and you're diving into a black hole, and you had 1,000-pound bombs in the airplane, and we think what possibly happened is he pickled one and then pulled, and the airplane departed and took him into the ground.
So he may have had an uncontrolled flight into the ground as a result of stalling the airplane.
Yeah, he had stuff coming up around him, but the wingman didn't see anything hit him. There, didn't see any flash at all until the ground. And then the other three guys were hit. He was the only loss. The other three guys were prisoners of war. For the one right in the beginning, all the way through to the month and a half, and the other one's about 2 weeks from the end.
See, so, Ted, let me interject. Don't forget, Ted was with the crew that were on land base, but we also had carriers operating, and they were held back. As you recall, they were simulating an amphibious assault, but at the end, they came into play, and they got to fly also. So, while most of the carriers.
The LHD or LHA was, or the two LHAs were held off with the amphibious fleet, and they diverted Saddam's attention to thinking there was going to be a landing. So basically we were hitting him on two fronts there, which kept everybody busy. And then when they realized, when it got far enough to where we were getting ready to start in on the ground war after 35 days of dropping bombs and stuff, the ship started launching 50 sorties a day to augment our flights. We had tremendous readiness. We had 90% readiness in the airplanes at all times. We only lost one sortie in my squadron to a electrical failure out of 1,300 sorties flown. The airplanes performed superbly, and of course the troops kept them up there. At the end of the war, what was interesting, and this is kind of carries through for all Harrier operations, Secretary of Defense, General Schwarzkopf said there were six major weapon systems that stood out in the war. One of them was the Harrier. And then the Secretary of Defense Cheney narrowed that down to three, A-10, M1A1, and the Harrier. Everybody was, wow, the Harriers really did a great job. And then same as with the Brits back in after the Falklands. They did a great job. Nothing could have done any better. About 6 months later, all of a sudden, all the problems with the Harriers were out. Well, you know, they didn't. They had short legs, and well, they were not really any better than anything else. You know, the conventional mentality that really doesn't care for Stovall started to come back into play. So it's kind of like the Rudyard Kipling "Tommy this and Tommy that" poetry. I'll leave it at that.
Lon, let's finish up the show and just say it's a safe thing to say that the United States has gotten its money's worth out of the investment in these airplanes, is it not?
Well, I would agree, and let's follow on with Ted's discussion to remind all the listeners that, you know, after the Gulf War experience, you have both Iraq and Afghanistan where these airplanes went in and they provided excellent support. And then the other thing to focus on is that the later versions of the airplane had the forward-looking infrared laser designator, and so the plane was capable of delivering both laser-guided and JDAM weapons with precision accuracy. And another thing that I think the audience really needs to focus on, today aircraft are ISR platforms, intelligence, surveillance, and strike, and with the FLIR, pilot up at the higher altitudes can detect the guy on the ground and bomb with accurate precision. So in Iraq and Afghanistan, Harriers were, AVAPs, were really called in to do both no air-to-air. They were doing strike and reconnaissance, and they were really a critical platform for the ground forces. So I believe we did get our money's worth out of them. And the other thing to keep in mind is F-35 is great, okay, but because of the economic and development issues, the current plan for the AVAP with the Marine Corps is 2025 plus that this airplane will still be in service.
And this airplane has not just operated in those places. We only occasionally hear, but it in fact has been active in places like Bosnia-Herzegovina back in the 90s. In fact, there were two of these aircraft flying escort during the O'Grady rescue. And of late, we've been hearing more and more about strikes in Yemen and in East Africa.
Libya.
You know, we've been hearing about strikes in Yemen and East Africa. This airplane's got a lot of good days left in it.
Yeah, that's true. And and it's not just us. The Italian Navy and the U.S. Marine Corps embarked off Somalia were both providing air support during that issue down there, and the Italians have done quite a bit of work with their Harriers on there. There were Marines in Libya. The Harriers were on the LHA in that area there. They didn't participate much because we held back there, but they were ready to go if they were necessary.
Lon?
Now, one other smart thing that occurred that I think many of the readers or the listeners have heard about, the U.S. government bought all of the assets from the retired U.K. Royal Air Force airplanes. Now, I want to make everything clear here that they were not bought to put into service. They were bought for their engines and spare parts because the airplanes that the Royal Air Force flew had different avionics suites and other things. But the U.S. government's done a good job. This is buying parts, engine cores, that type of thing, to keep the current Marine Corps systems viable for as long as possible.
So let's ask the real quick question because we're coming up on the end of our time. Ted, what do you do for a living now, and what do you have ahead for you?
Well, I'm as old as Methuselah now, so I've been working for McDonnell Douglas and Boeing since I retired from the Marine Corps in the international side there for marketing and sales and Super Hornets, and I'm about 3 to 5 months away from retiring and going into what Lon does is writing some stuff, putting down some stories I've got in my head and some observations on today's aviation and that type of stuff.
Excellent. And Lon, what are you working on right now? When are we going to see some new book material from you?
Well, I was literally sitting here editing book 4 on the AV-8B. I have 3 books through Osprey, one in each of the campaigns, one in the Gulf War, one in Iraq, and one in Afghanistan. And I was editing book 4 and writing some other stuff. So I'm retired in writing and consulting.
Gentlemen, I want to thank you for coming and talking about a great airplane today. I hope we get to have you on the show again soon. We have to go and call it an end because we are coming out of time. So, gentlemen, thank you so much.
Our pleasure.
Thanks, John.
And with that, we come to the end of another edition of Military Monday. Please join me tomorrow at 1 p.m. I'll be joining Daria Gigiovanni and Lisa Tarvis for the one-year anniversary show for RightStream on Blog Talk Radio. It's been an interesting year, and we're going to talk about some of our adventures doing this. Until then, this is John Gresham, and this has been Military Monday.
I took a flat to a pawn shop for a broken guitar. I took a flat to a pawn shop. How much is that guitar? I took a flat to a pawn shop. I got me that guitar. What's a flat in a pawn shop to me? Saw a man on the TV in a mask with a gun. A man on the TV, he had a 10-year-old son. I saw a man on the TV, his son had a gun. Cherished freedom, freedom never cried.